Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm John Cable, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Marilyn Lake about her 2019 book, Progressive New World: How Settler Colonialism and Trans-Pacific Exchange Shaped American Reform. The paradox of progressivism continues to fascinate more than 100 years on. Democratic but elitist, emancipatory but coercive, advanced and assimilationist, progressivism was defined by its contradictions. In Progressive New World, Marilyn Lake points to the significance of turn-of-the-20th century exchanges between American and Australasian reformers who shared racial sensibilities, along with a commitment to forging an ideal social order. The book demonstrates that race and reform were mutually supportive as progressivism became the political logic of settler colonialism. Settlers defined themselves in New World terms, both against Old World feudalism and the indigenous peoples that they considered backward and primitive. Lake also shows how indigenous people at times employed the language and tools of progressivism for their own ends, reshaping the broader progressive movement in the process. Marilyn Lake is a professorial fellow in history at the University of Melbourne and was formerly president of the Australian Historical Association from 2010 to 2014. A renowned scholar of Australasian and settler colonial history, she has authored, co-authored, and edited many books, including 2008's Drawing the Global Color Line, White Men's Countries, and the International Challenge of Racial Equality, co-authored with Henry Reynolds. Marilyn Lake, welcome to New Books in Native American Studies.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much for being here. Before we get going with the book, I wonder if you might tell us a little bit about yourself and specifically what led you to the topic and how you became interested in the history of settler colonialism.
Sure. Well, broadly speaking, I'm a political historian of Australia and Australasia and settler colonial societies more generally. And as settler colonialism became an increasingly useful framework in which to think about Australasian history, it also invited us to consider histories more comparatively and transnationally. And with the book I did with Henry Reynolds, Drawing the Global Color Line, which was published in 2008, we became completely engaged with transnational history and argued that you can't really understand national histories without taking into account transnational movements. And we were particularly focused on the idea of a white man's country and saw that this had to be understood historically in a much larger frame than the national one. And just like settler colonialism, that also demands that we see histories of settler colonialism as much broader than simply the histories of nation states.
Right. In that book, you discussed, I'm remembering, Australasia, the United States, as well as places like South Africa.
Yes, and slightly New Zealand and Canada. And we importantly, one of the shifts in that book was I'm really interested as well in historical agency and the political agency of peoples, and particularly oppressed or subordinated peoples, rather than treating them simply as victims of white men or whatever. We wanted to write about the historical agency of, in the case of Drawing the Global Color Line, the book starts with the migration, the great migrations of Chinese peoples across the Pacific Ocean in the 19th century, both again to Australasia and also to North America. And we wanted to argue that those migrations, that modern mobility, if you like, were really important in shaping those societies. And similarly, in this book, in Progressive New World, following the theoretical work of a number of scholars like Lorenzo Veracini and the late Patrick Wolfe, I wanted to point to the historical political agency of Indigenous peoples both engaging with progressive thought but also rejecting it, also seeking to challenge its premises.
So early in this book, Progressive New World, you describe several individuals who were in touch with one another in the late 19th century, among them Charles Pearson. Pearson admired what he saw as the democracy of Indigenous people in Australia and deplored British colonialism in India, but also was fundamentally disgusted by Native people, often viewing them as simply in the way. So how do you explain all this in one person, one sort of complicated person?
Yes, and indeed, in a way, what you point to is it's very useful to explain these contradictions and tensions by looking at individual people. And as you suggest, Progressive New World focuses on the exchange of ideas and the formulation of people's subjectivities, their sense of self, in relation to other people. And so Pearson is immensely interesting in that he's English, and English by birth and education. And to me, he was interesting too because he was a historian, a medieval historian. But he was very fiercely engaged politically against British class systems, against the inequalities of countries like England, against the outrageous gap between the rich and the poor. And like many radical liberals in the late 19th century in England, he determined to try and forge new societies in which those inequalities were done away with, in which the state would be enrolled to ease those discrepancies. And he was particularly friendly with Charles Eliot Norton, an American professor of fine arts. Norton, of course, was interested in democracy in the United States. Pearson was interested in forging a new democracy in the Victorian self-governing colony in Australia. And he migrated to Australia a couple of times. He migrated, then returned to England, and then came back again. He lived in South Australia and then in Victoria, where he became a politician and a journalist. So he worked as a journalist and a member of the Legislative Assembly. And he contributed in a large way to what was then called state socialism, the regime in Australia which enlisted the state to bring about all sorts of equalities and reforms was generally referred to as state socialism, as the state was so central to its vision. But here, this is where being a white man was quite central, because these theorists also considered that white men should be equal to each other, but their whiteness ensured that their sense of citizenship, for example, was a racialized one. And I think this is really crucial to understand with progressivism, that on the one hand, citizenship was seen, you know, as having major potential, but on the other hand, citizenship in settler colonial societies was a racialized condition.
And they're pretty explicit about this, aren't they?
They absolutely are explicit. And it's interesting to me as a historian that until maybe 10, 15 years ago, historians didn't used to see what their subjects said. That is that their subjects were indeed extremely explicit about being white men and about the superiority of white men and the virtues of white men, about indeed Australia called itself the Commonwealth, the Federation from 1901 called itself a white man's country, as did, you know, Canada and New Zealand and the United States, and particularly parts of the United States, the South of the United States. They were very explicit. And in fact, I was really interested when I was researching this to find that their contemporaries, including Du Bois, for example, the African-American theorist, the great African-American writer, he looked around him and he too saw this ascendant politics of whiteness, and wrote an essay about that, which is much less well known than his essay about black folk. And he said, what is this whiteness that everywhere is around us? He was writing around, 1902, 1905. What is this whiteness that everyone in the world, deems so valuable? And at one point he says, whiteness is the ownership of the earth forever and ever, which, was a very sort of perceptive claim about these settler colonial societies, which were busy not just dispossessing Indigenous peoples, but also, as I mentioned earlier, keeping out Asiatic peoples. These were white men's countries.
You're referring to Souls of White Folk, right? From Darkwater.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
So sort of dovetailing with that, how did shared settler colonial pasts give Australians and Americans a sort of shared language and open-mindedness to one another?
Yes, well, crucial to my analysis is the idea of subjectivity, a political subjectivity and a sense of self, a sense of who they were. And they had, around 1900, they had a very strong sense of themselves as descendants of the British or English, and as I said, as white folk, as being white, and as being living in frontier societies. They often talked about frontier societies, and similarly as being pioneers. They used the trope of the pioneer all the time, both in the United States and Australia. And not surprisingly, they read the same sorts of stories and narratives about, in their national histories about, white men being pioneers in the wilderness and settling these countries. And, like Theodore Roosevelt's Winning of the West is a classic of its kind. So they shared a sense of racial history, and they shared a sense of self as white settlers undergoing similar experiences.
So you're among a growing number of scholars to point to the exclusion that was built into progressivism that you've been sort of discussing, most notably the exclusion of non-white people from the political process. But progressives also pushed for women's suffrage and for many things that we would today consider progressive. So how do we reconcile these contradictory impulses of exclusion on the one hand and inclusion on the other?
And indeed, progressives had in mind a particularly important role for white women. And here again, we have to think of womanhood as racialized, of course. It's not all women who are seen to be playing a leading role in progressive reform. And I have a chapter in my book on maternalism, on the political project of maternalism that was very big amongst white women, again, in the United States and in Australia, where white women, left the domestic domain and saw themselves as having a very important role in the public world, not just only as shaping sort of welfare reform for the societies, but also having a maternal role with regard to the protection, as they would have said, and assimilation of Indigenous peoples.
So this is where you talk a little bit about the removal of Indigenous children too, right?
Indeed. I mean, one of the general points I argue in my book is what I'm doing is not just, as it were, sort of including Native Americans or Indigenous peoples in a history of progressivism, but rather I argue it's not until we look at Indigenous history, it's not until we look at the history of these countries as settler colonial histories, can we really understand progressivism. You can't understand progressivism until you understand the histories of Indigenous peoples in these countries. It's crucial to see that. And so historians used to write about progressivism in terms of how the figure of the child was central to progressive visions about, the home and education and reform. And increasingly with regard to children's rights, in the United States, the Children's Bureau, maternal bureau, the motherhood policies, infant welfare, mm-hmm. the child was central to this vision. But of course, the child was also central to progressive intentions with regard to Indigenous peoples, who were, if they weren't dispossessed and destroyed, they were to be assimilated, absorbed into these new nation states. And central to the strategy was the child, was the native child, the Indigenous child. And we know, you know, the appalling history of boarding schools in the United States and in Canada, and similarly such institutions in Australia, where children were, particularly so-called half-caste children, were systematically removed from their families and communities to be brought up by white families and white institutions. So if you think about progressivism, you can see that these policies were central to progressivism. And it really surprised me when I first started researching the larger history of progressivism, how histories generally, especially US histories, of progressivism completely ignored Indian policy or, you know, ignored Native Americans, but they would often include immigrants as subjects to be Americanized, but rarely did they go in to discuss policy with regard to Native Americans in this frame of progressivism.
And listeners who are familiar with federal Indian policy will know that this is the time of the Dawes Act, and a similar piece of legislation in Australia as well, right?
Yes, and indeed I was struck by the timing. One of our more interesting small-L liberal, as we would say, radical intellectual political leaders, Alfred Deakin. I start with a quote from Alfred Deakin's papers in the 1880s or thereabouts, when he says something really progressive about how progressives and Democrats are only interested in the future. They have no interest in the past. You know, the past was what they were trying to get away from, the oppressions of the past, of the old world in Britain. And it's therefore interesting that, I mean, Deakin is, he's in Victorian politics and he has the role of chief secretary, as it was called, sort of in charge of domestic policy, and he introduces one of the first pieces of legislation to regulate Aboriginal peoples, and that is the when's the Dawes Act, 1887, is that right?
That's right.
His Act is 1886, the year before.
Right.
And they're very, very similar. I mean, they're basically about trying to assimilate Native peoples into the larger polity, opening up, taking their land from them so the land could be opened up to white settlers. You know, you can see in this policy how the two things are completely tied together, and that Native peoples ideally would be assimilated into the broader community to take their place, you know, one day in the future as useful citizens, as they might have put it. So this policy of giving up what in the United States was called surplus land, for goodness sake, giving this surplus land up to settlers was very similar to the Australian policy. You know, this is where it's crucial that these are both settler societies, and they're settler societies, of course, also resting on immigration, you know, so endless influx of waves of migrants are land hungry. They want more land and they take land from Indigenous peoples.
And of course, Patrick Wolfe, who you draw on, gives us language to talk about that in, you know, the logic of elimination and things like that.
Indeed. That these new societies, and that's what's interesting about them being such self-consciously new societies. I opened the book again with the Harvard philosopher Josiah Royce saying that as he was growing up in California, he always wondered what his parents meant when they continually talked about this being a new society. I was so struck by that. You know, there's self-conscious aboutness about being new societies. And of course, I mean, unlike England, and to be new societies, of course, they rested on land taken from other societies. You know, they could only construct themselves as new societies because they rested on the dispossession of Indigenous peoples in those places. So the two processes are completely intertwined, as well as the conceptions of what those societies are like. And I argue in Progressive New World that part of the ideology, if you like, of progressivism, and particularly it's particularly evident in Australia, but also in the United States. I mean, Theodore Roosevelt goes on about this a lot, that they, in a way, they redeem themselves in these new worlds. They redeem themselves, as they think, by building, you know, new advanced democratic societies. These are new democratic societies unlike anything seen in old world Europe.
So in the book's final section, and of interest to many listeners, you discuss the Red Progressives, quite prominently the Society of American Indians, for whom progressivism was an avenue for achieving their own political ends. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, I was again quite struck by the parallels in Australia and the United States that, because as I said at the beginning, I'm interested in political history, and I'm interested in the political agency of groups who have been subordinated or oppressed, and the ways in which those groups are able to speak and make demands. And so I'm interested in the long history in both countries, and I know much better the Australian history, of Aboriginal rights campaigns. How did Aboriginal peoples come to make claims for rights? What kinds of rights? You know, the sort of shift from rights to citizenship to rights, land rights, the very concept of land rights, and self-determination. So I'm interested in that broader history. And I was struck that, of course, progressivism as an ideology was so pervasive, and the idea that progressive thinking was, you know, what was required to build a modern society. It was the basis of a modern citizenship, of a democratic citizenship. So in the 1910s, 1920s, progressive Indigenous peoples who thought of them or wanted to be or had a vision of being progressive often formulated their claims within these frameworks, you know, how they could and would become progressive citizens. But at the same time, what was so interesting was that they also realised that progressivism, inherent to progressive politics, was the disparaging of what progressives considered to be primitive or barbaric societies. Progressivism put itself against tradition. To be progressive was not to be traditional. And so Indigenous reformers realised that they wanted, while claiming progressive citizenship, they did not want that to be at the expense of recognising the value of their own cultures, their own societies, their own values, their own writings, their own sense of self. And in both cases, both in Australia and the United States, their claims to land rights, to try and get land returned to them, to try and reclaim land that had been taken, this became quite central to Indigenous progressivism in both countries, as well as, the rights to traditional ceremony, to culture, to custody of their children. And so what I argue is that in challenging progressivism to move beyond its vision of a sort of homogeneous polity where sameness was everything, in challenging progressivism to recognise difference, to recognise the value of cultural difference, Indigenous reformers led the way in the 20th century in reforming, in changing what would come to be seen as progressive. They led the way in persuading progressivism to become more multicultural, if you like, in persuading people that to be progressive was to recognize multiculturalism, to recognize difference, and also in both the United States and Australia, in recognizing the importance of history, the importance of the past, the importance of the history of dispossession. So unlike what Alfred Deakin had said about for progressives, the future is everything, they argued really strongly in both cases that central to building a future was recognizing what had happened in the past, the century of dishonor.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a sense that there's sort of a dialectic that red progressives impact mainstream progressivism just as much as the other way around.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I wanted to explore, that it's not, as it were, simply a matter of Indigenous progressives being derivative in that sense, but rather they start to formulate a political program within that progressive framework, but then quickly realize that they want to point to the centrality of what happened in the past and also to different sorts of rights. So yes, the right to citizenship, but not just citizenship. Land rights, the rights to culture, the rights to children, the whole sort of lot of different sets of rights. So exactly, they challenge progressivism. And in doing that, as I say, in the 20s and 30s, they paved the way for progressive thinking itself to change, you know, that what we might now regard as progressive is not what was regarded as progressive, you know, in 1905 or something.
So what do mainstream progressives think about what red progressives are saying in the first two decades of the 20th century?
Yes, that's a good question. I mean, by and large, let's say, and actually the other thing too about speaking about Indigenous progressivism in Australia and the United States, in Australia the organisation was called the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association. So it was in their title. In the United States, as you said, it's the Society of American Indians, the first all-Indian national. Actually, this is the other thing about these organisations. They were very national in their claims and their visions. They made claims on the nation. And so the Society of American Indians was famously the first organization whose membership was confined to Indians. And they wanted to create what they called an all-Indian public opinion for the nation. And similarly in Australia, although this organization largely functioned in the state of New South Wales, its name, the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association, signalled their desire to speak for the nation, to intervene in national politics. So what was the response of white mainstream societies? In Australia, not much really immediately. One of the central political challenges of the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association was to the general policy of protection, as it was called. There were protection boards in each state in Australia that regulated the lives of Aboriginal peoples, and they wanted those boards to be dismantled, discarded. And it's in this context that they start to articulate a claim to self-determination. And that phrase is used a lot in the 1920s. Among Aboriginal people in Australia, the desire, the demand for self-determination. And that, of course, also picks up on the broader context of President Wilson's vision of self-determination at the League of Nations, which had happened in 1919. Now, that demand for self-determination and the dismantling of the Aboriginal protection boards, I mean, those things finally come about, but they take a long while. And so the Aboriginal Protection Board was changed in name to a welfare board, you know, so they got rid of the sort of language of protection, but it was still pretty regulatory until about the 1950s and 60s. And self-determination becomes a sort of nationally proclaimed policy for Aboriginal people by the 1960s and 70s. In the United States, change happens earlier with John Collier and the Merriam Report in the 1920s into Indian administration. And one thing that's really different in both countries is that, as you said before, Indian policy in the United States is federal from the beginning. And so policy change can take place at that federal level, and that's what happens in the so-called Indian New Deal in the 1930s, where there's more gestures towards providing self-determination to tribes. So there's a sort of local federal relationship, whereas in Australia, the administration is all state-based. So things happen at a piecemeal, in a piecemeal way, state by state in Australia. And one of the important things in Australia is that there's a referendum held in 1967 to give the federal state, the Commonwealth, power to make legislation for Aboriginal peoples. And that's when, you know, you can then start having broader national policies of self-determination. In the United States, it's already a federal policy. There's already the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so, again, interestingly, and I write about this quite a bit in the chapter in Progressive New World, a lot of the radicals, or they called radicals, in the Society of American Indians, their aim is to get rid of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. You know, they see this as very paternalist and protectionist in the same way as in Australia they demanded to get rid of protection boards. John Collier becomes the Commissioner for Indian Affairs, doesn't he, in 1933,
something like that?
Yeah, something like that. And this is seen, I mean, he works his way through Indian reform through the 20s and 30s. And actually, I also argue that he and his career also should be seen. He comes out of reform movements, in community-based reform movements in New York, initially involved in policy with regard to migrants, to immigrants. And so, you know, he's a classic, progressive idealist, and he works across various areas of policy before he becomes Commissioner of Indian Affairs. And then I write about how there's a lot of ambivalence amongst different Indian communities across the United States about this new proclaimed policy of self-determination, and some resist it for various reasons. So the other thing that's important there, I think, is the women in the Society of American Indians are very important, and I look at some of their different takes on progressivism and reform. And it's interesting, I think maybe in 1911, in the year that the organization's founded, that Laura Cornelius Kellogg puts forward a proposal for a sort of version of self-determination at the tribal level based on reservations and their industrial capacity, which I suggest is actually quite far-seeing. In some way she anticipates what Collier does 20 years later. But at the time in 1911, she's pretty much ignored, partly because then the whole idea of reservations and the continuing reservations themselves are seen as oppressive. So there's a lot of dispute about what the status of reservations should be.
And you make the point earlier too that the successes that progressivism had early on in the U.S. were mostly at the local and state level, whereas yes. Indian policy happens at the federal level, so maybe it takes it some time to catch up there.
And also the New Deal itself in the United States, of course, is not enacted at the federal level until the 1930s. Yeah. So on the one hand, I mean, this is interesting about settler colonialism. Clearly, you know, both societies share a history of settler colonialism, and it's a useful framework in which to see the national histories. On the other hand, of course, the national histories are distinct, and their polities and their politics are distinct. So, and both are federations. So that's sort of interesting too, about how the powers are divvied up between the federal state and the states and then the local level. One reason why there's such trans-Pacific exchange of ideas around policies to do with labor and minimum wages and feminism is because these things are enacted at the federal level in Australia. So they have, you know, they're quite influential. They have quite an international power. Whereas in the United States, it's often more often at the state level or the local community level. And in Indigenous affairs, this is interesting because, as you say, policy is enacted in the United States at the federal level, but in Australia, that's the one area in this sort of series of reforms that is still state-based. So you don't have the same sort of national policies or national investment in reform of Indigenous policy in Australia until the 1960s. So you don't, I mean, some reviewers have commented on the fact that I trace these exchanges of ideas and between people in a lot of areas, but this doesn't happen with regard to Indigenous policy. And why is that? And that's an interesting point. And in response to that, I think one reason is obviously that in Australia it's state-based administration. A second reason, I think, is that in both cases, policymakers, reformers, their claims were on the nation. Like, it was really important that they try and shape the nation. And so they weren't so interested, I don't think, in what was happening internationally. And indeed, there's a history here to be looked at of when Indigenous affairs is first sort of taken up by international bodies. And it's not really until with the United Nations that you start to get working groups on Indigenous policy. And until that, and that's, I mean, that's really interesting too, because in Australia, Aboriginal people, when they, if they identified internationally, as I set out, they were just as likely to identify with Black international groups rather than Indigenous ones. And this is really interesting too. So they're quite influenced by Marcus Garvey's organisation.
UNIA.
Yeah, that's right. And therefore, with what's coming out of New York with regard to international Black politics. So that's another interesting thing is the potential, the ambiguities of identification with regard to Indigenous peoples, like with whom do they identify. I talk about when I'm writing about Charles Eastman that he went to the Universal Races Congress in London in 1911, and that was probably the first big international conference about racism, and it was huge and had representatives from all over the world, from hundreds and hundreds of places. And one reason it was set up then was to address the tensions between the so-called East and the so-called West, that is between Asian countries and West. And those tensions were arising in part about the immigration exclusion policies enacted in both the United States and Australia. But it's called the Universal Races Congress because it, you know, wants to bring together people talking about their own races. And so Charles Eastman is there talking about the American Indian, which he gives a very interesting paper, which is basically a history, as he sees it, of American Indian experience. And he sees the reservation period, you know, this is a dark period of imprisonment, which again is interesting as background to him then becoming a founding member of the SAI. And also Du Bois is there too, and he will shortly become a founding member of the Association for the Advancement of Coloured Peoples and forming the magazine Crisis in the United States. So there are international movements afoot in which people place themselves or talk about themselves as races, as well as making claims on the nation state to be sort of equal citizens in those nation states. And I also point out that for many of the male reformers, like Eastman and like Du Bois, they think of these things in terms of their manhood. They always talk about their manhood and redeeming their manhood and their status as men. You know, they feel oppressed as men. So these are very complicated things.
Right. So it sounds very complicated, but it also sounds like this is all very important stuff. So if you can sum it up in just a little bit, what have earlier historians of progressivism missed in not employing the settler colonial framework? Because it seems like there's so much there.
Yes, indeed. No, I think that's one of the astonishing things. Because as you know, there's a ton of stuff written about progressivism in the United States. And I combed through all that and I was quite astonished that there was virtually no attention to Native American policy and policymaking. And I thought, how could this be? Because when I looked into it further, I found that Native American policymaking, you know, with all those white women being field matrons and taking the children away, and the whole thing was an assimilation and education towards, you know, civilization. The whole thing was so central to the progressive vision. It was so central to the progressive project. So that I came to see, if you looked at Indian history, if you looked at policy with regard to Native Americans during this period, you would get quite a good idea of what progressivism was about. Now, what historians, of course, started to look at the African American experience, which, by the way, of course, one reason those of us from outside the United States because African American history is much more prominent in the United States than Native American history. And it's as if some of us think, countries can only deal with one founding trauma. You know, the great founding trauma of the United States was slavery. And therefore, it's as if American historians have been quite late to come to see settler colonial history as a crucial framework for American history. You know, that if they could see settler colonial history as the central framework, I mean, only in the last 10 years or so, you know, there's that great book on California, on the genocide in California.
Madly.
Yeah, that's right. Only quite recently, and in fact, I spent a year at Harvard in 2001 as professor of Australian studies there, and that was really interesting for all sorts of reasons to do with this. One was at that point, Australian Aboriginal peoples were having a high point in terms of national prominence and national visibility and discursively, if you like, whereas that appeared to me not at all to be the case with Native Americans. And so I asked my students, I asked my students if they could name some Native Americans, and they were really hard pressed, you know. Most couldn't name any. I mean, and this would have been astonishing in Australia, where several Australian Aboriginal political leaders were really well known, but also film stars and people in dance companies and, you know, a whole lot of people. And so I was really struck by that. And one or two said, there's that guy. Is he in the Senate? Is that one in the Senate? And so that alerted me to the relative comparative lack of discursive presence of Native American history in the United States. And the other thing, this has changed since then, I think, but the other thing that was happening was that when the history department there was putting up proposals for new jobs, new positions, they still treated Native American studies as another ethnic studies, so that you might have an Asian studies position or a Latin American studies or whatever. And I was astonished at this because already – discursively, history had changed so much in Australia that people would never consider, you know, Aboriginal studies or something as just another ethnicity. You know, it was right. People used to say in Australia, you know, we are the invaded ones. They are the invaded ones. They're not, you know, this is sort of crucial. They're the first people, et cetera, et cetera. So these different positions of Indigenous peoples in the two countries' histories and political presence, I think, are really interesting. And part of that comes from the different political structures that there's the federal dominance in the United States, but there's also tribal government. So there's not a very strong national presence in Washington, was my sense. Anyway, I went off on a tangent.
That's fine.
What did you ask?
No, you answered the question and then some. But so just to change gears a little bit, this is in many ways, as you've suggested, a book about affinity, a book about connection, about communication across borders. So what sorts of sources do you rely on for a book like this?
Yes, indeed. Well, actually, and I should here give a plug to our national research grant scheme. The ARC stands for the Australian Research Council. And again, this is the difference between the two countries. I often joke about the ARC is a legacy of state socialism in Australia, which it is in many ways. And the other legacy of state socialism is that academics, historians, have had very generous access to very generous sabbatical leave schemes, whereby, you know, every 6 months or so. And combined with the resources, the ARC provides lots and lots of research fellowships, which are salaries, you know, for 2 or 3 or 4 years that enable people to do research full-time and also pays for them to go overseas to do research. So I could never have done Progressive New World without those resources. You know, I've enjoyed two research professorial research fellowships, which I've been extremely lucky to have. And then on top of that, paid, you know, travel money to go to the United States. So I did a lot of research for the book. Of course, you couldn't write a book like this unless you did do the research. This is the real challenge of transnational history. To do it properly, you really do need to do research in a lot of countries. And that was the same with Drawing the Global Colour Line. You know, we did research in a whole range of countries. And for this book, I did a lot of research in the Library of Congress, and a lot in the Massachusetts Historical Society, some in Wisconsin, some in California, you know. So I was able to, and in Harvard, to travel around and research archives and use libraries. And so you'll see from the sources that it relies on a whole range of sources ranging from, you know, legislation to parliamentary debates to inquiries, a lot of people's personal papers. I looked at Robert Valentine's papers. He was a progressive commissioner for Indian Affairs, appointed, I think, in 1909 by Roosevelt. His papers are in the Massachusetts Historical Society. I looked at a lot of personal papers, a lot of organisational papers, papers of the Society of American Indians, papers of the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association, and then lots and lots of newspapers and, you know, journals and stuff. So quite exhaustive, and really it builds on about 10 years' work, I would think, overall. And it also builds on my earlier interests in political movements. I've done a lot of work on the history of feminism, a lot of work on histories of movements for anti-racism, both on Chinese Australians as well as Aboriginal Australians. So it builds on, and also I've done a lot of work as a labour historian. So, you know, the book itself builds on accumulated work.
Well, thank you for that. And we have taken up quite a bit of your time today. But before we let you go, do you mind sharing what's next for you? Are there any new projects in the works?
Gosh, no, not a large one. I mean, part of my, as you said at the beginning, I've actually written and edited whatever quite a few books. I think about 14, and part of my and my work became more and more sort of global, transnational. And part of doing that, you know, it takes so long to write a book like that, so long to do the research. Mm. So, you know, I couldn't do another book like that. I do now more local things and, you know, chapters and articles and stuff. So I don't think I'll do another large book. I'm quite interested in the long and fraught history of equal pay or the lack of it, and also its international history. But I don't think I'll embark on that yet.
Well, thanks so much. And thank you again for being with us today and for talking.
Thank you, John.